Greetings. I am Shisada Akona Kamara, and welcome to Satsang with the Shambhala Center. You are beginningless. You are endless. You are divine.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in for Satsang tonight. This is Shisada Akona Kamara, and I welcome you here with me this evening. We're going to go ahead and get started. Take a nice deep breath for me, and let me clear the space. Mother, Father, God that I am, through the great central sun hierarchy, through the office of the Christ, through the order of Melchizedek, I call upon Archangel Michael to bring the sapphire blue ray. Cut away, cut away, cut away anything in all of our four lower vehicles, not emanating directly from our I Am presence. I now call on Archangel Zachiel, keeper of the violet flame. Blaze, blaze, blaze the violet flame through all of our four lower bodies. Transmute, transmute, transmute all the psychic debris Michael has cut free. I now bring forth the invincible ring pass knot and the mirror blue light of invisibility to completely surround each of us. And I call forth a shaft of pure Christ light for each one of you. And I ask that they be brought to the center of the earth, where I call on Archangel Gabriel to seal them. And I ask that the legions of Michael completely surround each tube of light. And now I ask that our vibrations be raised high above the psychic and astral worlds to the highest realm of illumined truth we each can attain at this time. And now, Mother, Father, God, we place ourselves in service to you and to humanity, and I place myself in service to all of you tonight. We ask that only that which is direct from you be permitted into our perceptions and that all else of the lower mind be kept out. And we ask that only that which is direct from you be permitted through us. And because we have asked this, we consider it so. So be it. Good. Come on back. So in the beginning of our program, you hear, you are beginningless, you are endless, you are divine. And here you are walking in this place that had a beginning and will have an end, and you're not feeling very divine, are you? Especially right now with Mercury retrograde running, no one's feeling divine right now. So let's talk a little bit about this. The thing that I want to make sure everybody understands, because of course I'm always having to kind of go back. I never know who's listening tonight, who's never listened before. And of course, so much of what I bring forward is not anything you're going to read in a book. Or see a video on, so I have to bounce around a lot. And I do want to touch base on this aspect that's a very fundamental and kind of the dissolution 101 part of the work. But it's necessary because, you know, a lot of people come into, they have the stirrings of the of spirit inside that says something's missing and I want to know what it is. And then they start searching around, and we have someone very near and dear to our hearts in the BBS audience who found us exactly that way, you know, kind of stumbled upon us and found what he was looking for in that stumbling process. So it's an interesting thing when you start this process, because some people start it from a place where they have done years and years and years of studying with different traditions. Some have done multiple traditions, and some have never done much of anything. I mean, like maybe they never even really went to church, and all of a sudden they end up in my sphere of influence. And so I have to kind of be able to address all of them from wherever they come in from. So let me address the space of you not feeling divine and not feeling beginningless and endless. And we can talk about that, which we addressed earlier here in Charlotte. So the child who comes into the world is subjected to the primal imprint. And the primal imprint is not, it's not a term you're going to see anywhere else. It's a very specific term that we use in the work as it was given to me. The primal imprint is the initial programming as such that was imprinted on consciousness at the moment of perceived separation. And I use that terminology very specifically because you will hear other teachers talk about the moment of separation. There was no moment of separation. And part of one of the teachings that I will give is that, you know, three magic words that are a little mind-boggling for a very long time until you have the experience of them. And the three magic words are, it never happened. And that mentally we can go, oh yeah, it never happened. I never separated from God. I never did, you know, none of that. But until it's experiential, it's not true for you. And until that time, it's just an intellectual exercise. But it is true. It never happened. So I use the terminology perceived separation because that's what happened. Consciousness perceived incorrectly that it was separate. Actually, that it could be, which then led to it perceiving that it was. And then that started the whole downward spiral into dense third dimensional manifestation and the reality that everyone on the planet is walking today. Very innocent, very innocent. But then what happens is consciousness ends up kind of stuck in this program. At that point, consciousness is referred to in my work as patterned consciousness because that's what it becomes. So rather than you being a conscious being, a conscious co-creator with the divine, as the divine co-creating through you as you. That's the reality of it. Instead of you experiencing it that way, you experience the opposite. You experience yourself as being subjected to reality, as if that was even possible, because you're the one who creates it. Now, that terminology is pretty widely accepted now. I create my reality. So there's loads and loads of people out there teaching that. I create my reality. Yeah. You're doing it every second, but most of it's unconscious. Most of it's unconscious and very innocent. But within it, you feel kind of, you know, that you're the victim of the world and the victim of others and just the victim all the way around. When it all comes down to it, it's really the victim to God. And of course, that whole concept is separation. So it feels very real, and it does, while it's never actually true because it never happened, the experience of it seems to be true enough until it's not. So a child comes into the world and is subjected to the primal imprint, and that primal imprint is the thing that does impress itself on the consciousness. And it tells that consciousness that it is separate. After that initial imprinting, and the initial program of separation, more imprinting comes. And that comes up until anywhere between the ages of 5 and 7, mostly from primary caregivers. And it's all of the conceptual learning that that child goes through that then reinforces the fact that the child is separate. What are some of the very first concepts that are taught to the baby? Mama, Dada, whatever the baby's name. You have to look at it from the perspective of a being who initially sees the world around it as not separate from it. And then recognize that now you've got a little, you've got the big face in front of you going, Mama, Mama, Mama. Patting yourself on the chest, Mama, you know, and the baby looks and the little mind starts working. And after a time, it makes the connection. Oh, that thing and Mama seem to go together. And whatever baby's name is, at some point, the connection is made. Oh, this thing and that name, that thing that I'm hearing seem to go together, starts to make all these connections. And all of those connections reinforce the initial imprint of separation. All of them. All of them. So imagine, you know, that child goes through this onslaught of conceptual teaching for years. And at that age between 5 and 7, it really is locked into place. And at that point, the child's little personality is formed. An initial imprinting will, or excuse me, continual imprinting will happen after that. But from 5 to 7 in there, it's done. Everything is locked into place. It's all there. All the guilt, all the shame, all the fear, it's all there. So you listening experienced that. And not only once, you've experienced it lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. And now becomes the journey home, you know, back to the place you never left, which seems so ridiculously paradoxical. A journey without distance to a place you never left. What on earth does that mean? And I love that quote. It's a journey without distance. What does that mean? It's a journey without distance to a place you never left. I believe that's from A Course in Miracles, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. But you know what's absolutely true? And that's the part of the absolute magic of awakening, because there will be a moment, a golden moment, where you will just, boy, does that ring true. You get it. You get it. And the moment is followed by laughter and tears and the most amazing grace. Until then, you just have to try to wrap yourself around it and keep plugging away to figure out what that means. Because that's all the mind knows to do with it. I got to figure that out. And of course, the mind can't figure it out. Right? Intellectually, it can try to make sense of it. And that's fine. And that's good. It needs to happen. You know, there's a really solid place in this work for contemplation. I recommend it to everybody. It's not just about sitting in meditation. It's sitting in contemplation. You know, sitting with a concept and allowing it to just be held very loosely in the mind and just looking at it allowing the space that's necessary. See, this is what happens, that the human believes it's the doer. So the human will take a concept, right? And it'll say, well, I don't understand it, and I want to understand it. So then the human puts itself to work to understand it. And it's like it takes the concept and it wrestles it to the ground. I'm going to make sense out of you, you know. Be like me in trig class when I was in high school. I wasn't very successful, but that was the attitude I had because it made no sense to me whatsoever. But that isn't how understanding comes in, very rarely. It's always in the moment when you relax into it, you know, where when the doer disappears and the observer just witnesses. Those are the moments where understanding really does come, you know. The doer has to fall away. It just falls away. So sit in contemplation. Look at something, but just look at it. Look at it. And when the question comes, look at the question and allow the question to lead to the next question and look at that question and look at all of them. And look at the answers that seem to present themselves. And sometimes you'll have moments of amazing clarity that come, and they're so precious. And write them down, please. Please write them down. Because for as amazing as they are in the moment, and you'll be like, oh, I can't believe it's always been right there in front of my face. I never saw that. How could I have never seen that? And you have this experience of, oh my gosh. Like once you've seen that, you will never forget it. Guess again, I promise you're going to forget it. Write it down. Write it down. Refer back to it often. The energy of it is in the writing. When you write it down in that moment, it's really beautiful. I promise you will forget it. Because for the amazing moments of clarity, life goes on, the programming kicks back in, and you go unconscious again. And I say this from personal experience, as I say everything. Yeah. I've had many experiences where I've gone back and I did write everything down. And I'll go back and read something and I was like, wow, like it's brand new for me. I had that experience, you know, and I have to really track it. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I did. Because I will have forgotten, like completely forgotten. And they're magical and just so amazing. So you have this little imprinted child, you know, this little bitty patterned consciousness moving through the world. And it's like a sponge that soaks up everything around it. And it soaks up, you have to remember, because it's not just like the brain. So people want to say that you've got a little kid and the little kid has a brain. So through the child's senses, it pulls in information into the brain. That's how the world would look at it. Well, there's a whole lot more going on than just that. The consciousness that is utilizing that form and utilizing those senses is taking in everything. So it's taking in everything you can't see as well. And it uses all of it as it builds its database of little Johnny, you know. So there are things along the way that this little sponge named Johnny picks up. And they are things that get imprinted so strongly into the program of Johnny that Johnny will function from them without ever knowing he learned them. And one of those is called the winning position. This is a really big teaching. This would be the good time to pull out a notebook and a pencil, if you have one handy. So the winning position, what is that? Okay, so you got a little one watching everything going on in the world around it. And so let's say one day Johnny hears voices in the other room, and it catches his attention. He's sitting, he's playing with his little Transformer toys, and he hears voices, but something catches his attention because it's not normal. They aren't the kinds of voices he's used to hearing. And so he just stops and kind of listens. And then as he's listening, the voices are escalating. It's getting louder and louder. And then he recognizes the voices. It's mommy and daddy. But they sound different than normal. So, of course, the questioner is there for Johnny. There's the initial surprise of what is that, you know? Huh. And then the questioner. Why are they doing, I don't understand. Like, what's happening? And the confusion, right? So little Johnny's spiraling already. Without even being aware, he's spiraling. He is spiraling. So he has this inner sense that something's not quite okay because of the energy. You have to remember, it's not just what the immediate senses pick up. He's also picking up the energy that's coming out of mom and dad. Children are very attuned to that. So he feels the energy of conflict in a way that he hasn't experienced before. And he has this inner understanding that this is kind of, you know, this is like the flashing yellow light, the little warning light. So rather than just running out, you know, to give mommy and daddy a hug or whatever, he has this sense to be cautious. So Johnny gets up and he walks over to his bedroom door and he kind of stands at the door and listens. You know, most little kids have had some kind of an experience around this. I remember listening. My parents like never fought, and I mean never. And I remember one time, how old was I? I must have been maybe 10. I was a little older, but I remember we had a basement where I grew up. It was like our family room. And I remember I had gone to bed and I heard voices down in the basement. And it was the same thing. It was like, what the heck? You know? So I got up and I walked to the top of the stairs and I could hear them. They were arguing downstairs, but they didn't have raised voices, but they were having a dialogue. And I was convinced they were getting divorced. I mean, that was it. Which I know sounds so naive and so innocent. It really was, because my parents didn't argue. They just didn't. I'm not kidding when I say I really grew up in the Cleaver household. So I had parents who didn't fight. So the one time they had an argument and I caught it, I was like devastated. Oh my God. they're fighting. That must mean they're going to get a divorce. Ah, you know, which is ridiculous. But from a child's eyes, I didn't have any. To me, the, you know, what limited understanding I had of divorce, like that was it. Because you love someone. And if you love someone, you don't fight with them. So if you're fighting, it must mean what? You don't love them, right? I mean, like from a kid's perspective, it's pretty cut and dry. Oh my God, my parents don't love each other anymore. Oh. So there's little Johnny and he's standing at his bedroom door. He doesn't really want them to see him, but he wants to know what they're saying. It's important because, of course, you know, that little observer wants to catch it all, make sense of it. And he listens. And so mom and dad have their argument over whatever. So the whole time this is going on, he's listening and he's taking in all of it. Now, maybe they are keeping their voices low because they don't want to alarm him. Maybe they're yelling at each other. Maybe, you know, they're becoming violent. Maybe mom's throwing things across the kitchen. Maybe dad is, who knows? Maybe dad hits mom. Maybe dad punches the wall. Maybe dad is swearing at mom and calling her awful names. Maybe she's doing the same to him. Could play out any number of ways. But it doesn't really matter from this perspective, how it plays out. The fact is that what he's witnessing, regardless of how it's happening, what he's witnessing is conflict. And he's witnessing how conflict works. So he sees two opposing sides. He sees that they both, remember, mind functions from domination, manipulation, and control. So they're both doing what they can to preserve their own level of control by dominating the other, by manipulating the other, right? So like a lot of men revert to the domination technique. So for them, it might be that they get right in your face and they get the whole aggressive posture thing going. For a woman, maybe she is passive aggressive and she does the silent thing and she just shuts down. Well, that's manipulation. But it's the same thing. They both function to the same end. They both are looking to control the other. You see, it's not any different. The tactics are different, but the end result is the same, to control the other. And this is what he's witnessing. So however it plays out with the parents, he's learning how to deal with conflict. And I'm guessing he's not learning from very good role models. Not too many parents sit down and have a civil discussion over something they're upset about with each other. So what Johnny ends up doing, and he's not conscious of this, okay? You have to remember this. So when this happened with you, this is not something you were conscious of. You were just witnessing what was happening. But while you were witnessing it, this is what mind did with it. Mind will take that whole experience and it will break it down into, you know, you have the person who was victimized and you had the perpetrator. So you had the good guy and the bad guy. And in every conflict, you're going to see there's a good guy and a bad guy. Now, sometimes the roles reverse, and even a kid will see that. Sometimes, you know, the one who started out as the good guy ends up being the bad guy, and maybe then they bounce back. And you could see that in a lot of people when they argue, they have that back and forth thing. You know, one's really aggressive, and then something shifts, and then the other one becomes really aggressive, and then something shifts again, and then it goes back. And Johnny would witness that too. But he sees that they're are basically these two roles being played out. And he sees the result, the impact that each person has on the other. So he witnesses, when dad did this, this is the impact it had on mom. But when mom did this, this was the impact it had on dad. Mom did this and it made dad angrier. Dad did this and it made mom look frightened. Mom did this and it made dad move into a completely different space where he looked scared. And all of a sudden he started saying, no, please don't go. We'll figure this out. You see? And at the end of however it resolves itself with the parents, whether it's, you know, both of them, it expends itself and they come to some kind of a truce, or one of them storms out of the house and that's what ends it. Something will happen to end it, right? And what Johnny is left with is a sense of who just won that confrontation. Someone won it from the perspective of the observer. Someone came out on top. And all of that gets programmed in. All the things that he witnessed where he could say, I think remember, this is not conscious. Okay, so when I say he would say, I think, he's not really saying, I think. It's not conscious. It's all just taken in. But you would look at it and you could look at, you know, well, mom did that. And I think that kind of made it worse for her. It didn't help her to win. It made her more a victim. But when dad did that, boy, there was no question. He was in control. And so this is what happens when all of that is witnessed. Then what happens is the winning and the losing positions get programmed into the psyche of the child. And it's programmed. how that impacts you later in life is that later in life, and it can be when the kid's just a teenager, and usually that's when it starts popping up, preteen into teenage, the beginning teenage years. When that child feels victimized, and especially if he feels victimized in any way that would have any similarity to what he witnessed with the parents in that altercation, what will happen is that he will react, and he will react from the place of the winning position. So whatever worked for, in this situation, dad, when he had the big argument with mom, and it looked like he won when it was all done. Let's say it ended up, dad stormed out of the house, he grabbed the car keys, and he just took off. And when he took off, mom just crumpled into a heap on the kitchen floor, just cried for the next hour. Pretty clear cut, dad won that one, right? Here's mom sitting there in pain, and I'm watching her suffer for the next hour. And dad, you know, had a few choice words for her before he grabbed his keys and said, I'm out of here, and he left. He won. There's no question. If you're someone who reacts that way, if something happens, especially in relationship, intimate relationship with someone, and your first instinct is to run, look to your parent, to both of them. Look for the one of them that used to do that. Because you learned that someplace. You learned it. Are you someone that when, you know, something happens with your significant other and it's not good between you, you want to stay and duke it out? You learned that too. Because in your family, that was the thing that won. Sticking it out. Maybe it was a mother who wouldn't give up. Not from a place of being physically confrontational, but maybe she was really intelligent. Maybe she was smarter than your dad. And she could outwit him. And maybe she just kept pushing. Just kept pushing. So every time he'd come back with something, she could throw it back in his face and show him how he was wrong. And maybe that was what did it. At some point, he just gave up. You know? And maybe his giving up wasn't pretty. Maybe he swore at her, you know, and then stormed off. But in that situation, dad storming off, he's leaving. But there's no question, mom just won that battle. Because he's completely flustered, right? And he just gave up. Because he knows he can't say match wits with her. He can't beat her. So it doesn't have to be physically confrontational at all. Not at all. Or maybe, you know, maybe you had a mom who was, maybe you had an Italian mother who, you know, liked to throw things around and get all verbally crazy when she was upset. And maybe you had a dad who was really quiet and very passive. And when she went off, he just was like, you know, quiet as a little mouse, like was just afraid to say anything. Non-responsive. And that would program itself too. And what would you learn in that? It's a really beautiful thing. You'd learn as a child, if you really want to get under someone's skin, what do? Just don't respond to them, right? Because that's what that kid would have learned from his dad. Because that's what the dad would do. If the dad subconsciously wanted to irritate the mom, he'd know exactly what to do. If she's this, you know, really expressive Italian woman who's looking for a back and forth, and he's not going to give it to her, it would drive her crazy. She wants to fight. She wants to fight. And so from a very passive aggressive place, dad could learn to set it up so that he could play that role that would be there specifically to make her get upset. You see, that's, there's a lot of manipulation in there. He's not aware of it. Remember, this is like a really key point. Don't forget this. People aren't aware that they're doing this to each other. They love each other most of the time. Like they do actually love each other. and they are completely unaware that they're doing this. Why? Because it happens from a reactionary place. The reactive mind is not conscious. It's not conscious. It gets triggered, and it's part of the program that just kicks in from an instinctual level. And it's that instinctual thing. It was learned in the initial imprinting. And I refer to people who get go into rage, you know, and you can, and you've heard me say before, you watch them, their eyes go just completely black. When you see someone who's in that space, it's like they're gone, you know. The essence here, you know, the eyes are the window to the soul, and you can see the essence of a person through their eyes. Well, when you have someone who goes into rage, they disappear. They're just gone. That's what I mean. They're functioning. It's not even a conscious thing. It's just reaction. And it's reaction that was learned. They picked up what the winning position is. And on this highly polarized planet that we live on, a lot of that winning position is very ugly to look at. A lot of that winning position is rage. And it is physical abuse. And it is mental abuse and verbal abuse. And one of the most liberating things that you come into in your own work is when you really, truly recognize that even that, even physical abuse, mental abuse, sexual abuse, verbal abuse, all of that was innocent. That is something mind cannot get itself around because, of course, the mind, being as polarized as it is, says that's wrong and it's bad. And what I'm saying does not condone it. Don't get me wrong. It does not condone it. But the program is the program. And the essence of that person that you call mom or that you call dad is not even in the vicinity of them when that stuff is going on. That's just the program running. That is not them. It never was them. It never will be them. That's why I can look at anybody that I work with, and it doesn't matter what they bring to me as far as a life experience that they need to work on to, you know, dissolve out. They could have done the most horrendous things. I will not judge them for that. Because the one doing those horrendous things is the program. It is not them. When you really wake up to that and you recognize that even though you may have had to deal with horrendous things in your life, that the people that were your perpetrators, they did it because that's what they were taught to do. When you see that and you really get it, it changes everything. That to me is true forgiveness. It doesn't mean sexual abuse was okay. But what it means was the one who did it isn't that person. And I know that. And I love the person behind the program, you see. I love the essence that's underneath that program. But that essence is not part of the program. It can't be. That essence cannot exist anywhere near that program. When you see the innocence in all of it, you forgive all of it. Because it's only the story of victim that wants to hold on to any of it. It takes time to get there, certainly. And for those of you who've had really tough childhood situations, it takes time. This isn't something that happens overnight. And the funny thing is, it happens, it'll happen, you know, to you first. That's the thing that really seems to turn the tables. When you first start to see how you have been a perpetrator to others, how you have been the bad guy with others. And when you start to tear down all the justifiers that you've had in place for how you treat other people, and you start to tear down all the judgments you've had in place toward others, and you recognize that you treat them horribly because you've judged them for their past actions, and then you've justified your own behavior because they deserved it or because they aren't capable of giving you what you can give them, all of that selfish crap. When you get in there to that level and you see yourself, the personality, for as horrendous as it can be to people, and I promise you, every single one of you, you can be horrendous to other people. You don't want to see it about yourself, but I promise it's going on because it happens with everybody. Domination, manipulation, control. You manipulate people all the time. Of course you do. You start waking up to that and getting real with it, being honest, allow yourself to feel the pain that comes when you recognize you take someone that you really do love and you see how you've hurt them and it hurts you. That's the thing that will start to change your life. When you see how you've hurt other people and you see the innocence behind it, you see, that's the piece, because you'll see it. Oh my God. I never even thought about that. Like, I just did it. And I never even thought about it. Well, of course you didn't think about it. It was a reaction. Of course you didn't think about it. You don't decide consciously, I'm going to withhold my love from that person now. Now, sometimes you do. Generally speaking, though, you just do it. The passive-aggressive wife who, you know, the husband doesn't put the toilet seat down, so for the next hour, she gives him the cold shoulder. Did she consciously say, I'm going to be a real jerk to my husband for the next hour? No. She reacted from the place of judging him for what he did because it triggered her belief that, you know, it's wrong for a man to leave a toilet seat up. Maybe she has a real need for, like, clean, clear, neat spaces. And every time he leaves the toilet seat up, all she can think of is germs and just nasty. Right? And so in that moment, that's all she has to see is the toilet seat up. And now it's all running for her. She loves her husband. She doesn't, you know, she doesn't desire to be cruel to him. So she just, you know, in her place, because she wants to be a loving wife, well, she's not capable of, like, loving him in the moment, so she shuts down. And what she can't see is that her actions of shutting down hurts him. Because now he comes into her energy, he feels the energy, and he says, what's wrong? And she says, nothing. And she withholds her love from him. And in so doing, she hurts him. Now she might say, but I'm doing that because I don't want to hurt him. You know, if I yelled at him, that would hurt him. Honey, you're hurting him either way. Doesn't matter. He's hurting either way. And that's the space everybody on this planet has to come to. You have to be so willing. Everybody's willing to look at another person and say, you know, this is what you do wrong, and this is what you do wrong. And if you didn't do that, you'd be a lot happier. And if you didn't do that, you know, Dad wouldn't have left you. And if you, whatever. Really easy to do that. Really hard to look at ourselves with that same level of introspection and go, well, where did I mess it up? Rather than blaming someone else, I'm going to look at me first. How do I act that really helps to just perpetuate the whole mess that I'm in with that person anyway? Am I really as, you know, innocent in this whole thing as I've held myself to be, really? And you will find that the answer is a little disturbing and a little more than shocking for most of you. And I'll never forget when I really saw that for myself. It concerned me and my husband. And wow, you know, in my own world, like I had held myself up like I was some kind of a saint with my husband. And there was a thing that the way that I held how I viewed him and his line of work and the whole thing about being a husband and responsible for your family and money and all of this stuff, right? And what I really saw when I looked at it was how horrendous I had been to him for years. I mean, he couldn't do anything right. But I couldn't see it until I really went in and I was willing to see it for what it was. Because I had every justification in the book. And everybody, if I sat down and told you all this stuff, you'd all agree with me. Oh, you're absolutely right. That makes perfect sense. Well, of course. You'd all agree with me. And then we could all hate him. Oh, I didn't hate him. I loved him. And I was in pain. And I wasn't in pain because of what he did. I was in pain because of how I perceived what he did. I was in pain because of the stories that I wanted to believe. And those stories were impacted by what he did or what he didn't do. And it was the belief in those stories that hurt me. It wasn't him. And when I really got in and did the work, I was so ashamed of myself. I just sat and I just bawled my eyes out. I was so ashamed of myself. I couldn't even stand it. And in that moment, like I knew I had to make it right with him. Even this was stuff that had happened years ago. Years. It was over a decade. It had happened like over a decade before I did this work. Long time. And I was waiting for him when he came home from work that day because I had to talk to him. There was no way I could have waited another day. I had to apologize. And I mean a true apology, which means I didn't expect anything from him. He could have screamed at me. He could have said, you know, it's finally, now you see my blah, 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 whatever. He could have done whatever. It would not have mattered. All I needed to do was clear my conscience because I felt horrible. I had been wretched to him, wretched in a very manipulative, sneaky way. It was terrible. When it was all said and done, I felt like the weight of the world had been lifted off me once I came clean to him with no expectation. I really had none. And he actually didn't say a word to me when I did it. There's a backstory to that. He was told not to, but that's a whole other thing. So I literally got nothing back from him when I did this. But it didn't matter. See, it was all about me. This whole thing was about me. It wasn't about him. It was about me. And I needed to make it right. I needed to make it right with me. And the only way I could do it was to come clean to him and show him what I had seen and apologize from the very bottom of my heart. And from that moment, everything changed for me with him. Everything. I mean, I thought I loved him before. Holy cow. My heart was in such a different place after that. And it hasn't stopped. It's just expanded more and more. A beautiful thing. So that's what's waiting for all of you. There is a payoff here. The payoff is you live in peace. You live in this beautiful, centered, calm place where you know you are clear with everyone. Regardless of how they see you, you know you're clear with everyone because you're clear. And that's the point. All right, we're going to go into our meditation. Remember, the purpose of it is to help anything that has come up for you in this hour that I've been talking, to allow it to kind of clear out, make room for something bigger and better to come in. And I will facilitate that as well as I'm capable from this end. So please do stay with the meditation. And we will see you next week for Satsang. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. I love you all.
I dreamt I was born a girl, living alone in the world, passing the hours away. I looked into the face of sorrow, tempted by the taste of tomorrow and the scent of yesterday. But that was only a dream of a dream.
You are beginningless. You are divine.